the advancements that crypto, blockchain, and Web3 have been making, where they're baking in compliance and they're baking in the concept of privacy as opposed to anonymity, means that crypto can fix problems that TradFi has been fighting for years, especially in compliance. So that's why people like me want to see a nuanced evolution of rules and regulations that had good concepts, but maybe we modify it to adapt to this tech.
Get ready to jumpstart your week with the FCAT Crypto Brief, brought to you by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Join us as we delve into the hottest topics, from blockchain breakthroughs to DeFi revolutions and market happenings. We promise to go deeper than the headlines and deliver market insights you can't get just anywhere. Be sure to hit subscribe for your bi-weekly dose of crypto commentary. Quick disclaimer, we're here for education, not investment advice. Views expressed are of the hosts, not Fidelity or its affiliates. Crypto's a wild space, highly volatile, can become illiquid anytime, and is strictly for those with a high risk tolerance. Buckle up, enjoy the ride, and let's dive into what's been happening recently. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the FCAT Crypto Brief. I am Matt Allen, and today I have a wonderful crew. I'm joined by Parth Gaghava, David Shapiro, and a very special guest, former federal prosecutor for the DOJ, Amanda Wick. We're going to talk about Amanda's new book, her experience across the crypto industry, and dive into some fun and exciting trends writ large. But before we do that, Amanda, would you mind just introducing yourself to our audience? I'm sure you could do much more justice to this topic than I could.
Oh, no, you hit the highlights, actually. A former federal prosecutor, did a stint at FinCEN, was the chief of legal affairs at Chainalysis, went back to the government to lead the financial investigation for the January 6th committee, started a women's nonprofit that builds gender equality in the crypto, blockchain, Web3 ecosystem. And now I'm the head of Americas at a company called Verify VASP that builds best-in-class travel rules software and works with VASP regulators and crypto exchanges to make compliance better throughout the crypto ecosystem.
Very exciting. And we're going to have a wonderful conversation today. But before we get into that, I think there's just a couple of news stories that we should cover. The first one being an update on the Senate market structure bill. So as we noted on our episode 2 weeks ago, we were cautiously optimistic about some progress on a market structure bill coming out of the Senate, both out of the Senate Banking Committee and the Senate Agriculture Committee. However, last week, the Senate Banking Committee put out a draft that caused Coinbase to pull support for the bill. There were some key issues that Brian Armstrong noted, one of which is the treatment of stablecoin rewards, as Senate Banking is looking to close what they call a stablecoin yield loophole. So that definitely put the brakes on progress on this bill, as the hearing for the Senate Banking Committee draft was delayed. The Senate Agriculture Committee also delayed their draft. However, that was released earlier this week. So there's a lot of discussion, you know, going around the treatment of stablecoin rewards, as well as a few other key issues related to DeFi and tokenized equities. So we're not quite going to see the bill put before a full Senate vote, maybe as quickly as we initially thought, but there's certainly still progress being made on this bill. But with that, I think I can pass it over to David with an interesting story about Tether and Iran.
Yeah, so last week, Elliptic, who is a blockchain security, blockchain forensics firm, released a report showing that Iran's central bank has acquired at least $500 million in stablecoins, mostly Tether. And it appears that they have been engaging in market intervention to prop up their local currency and also accumulating these stablecoins to settle their international trade. And I think this is just a fascinating story on multiple levels. The first being that they didn't use Bitcoin and they chose to use stablecoins instead. So, you know, obviously Bitcoin has a lot of ideological appeal of being trustless and whatnot. And something like Tether, you know, requires the trust of a third party to not freeze your funds and whatnot. Yet Tether was still the choice. And I think this is due to multiple reasons, but probably the most being dollars and Tether just have the liquidity. And while on one hand it proves liquidity, on the other hand, Tether may not want their products to be associated with this type of activity. And it's plausible that the U.S. government asks them to freeze those funds. And, you know, there's a few other options there as well. You know, the the treasuries that collateralize those funds are held in a U.S. regulated investment bank. So you could go after the treasuries themselves. But I wanted to sort of pull Amanda in here since she has experience on the prosecution side of financial crimes and crypto and whatnot.
And I also have no poker face.
Right.
As you guys are talking about these things.
So, yeah, where do you see this going? Do you think that the federal government takes action here, or do they like the transparency of Tether and blockchains?
It's an interesting thing. So like a year ago, me and Alex O'Neill wrote an article called Raising the Alarm on Digitally Enabled Sanctions Evasion. And we talked about already existing sanctions evasion with Russia and some other countries that was happening in Tether. And it's not to pick on Tether, because obviously sanctions evasion, to your point earlier, is happening in other coins or other blockchains. But there is like a real, these things keep happening, but you don't really seem to see any kind of sanctions evasion effective program being put into place with Tether. And I think this idea that Tether US is going to somehow solve the issue, it creates this kind of like separate entity that is regulated in the United States. But I think, and this actually kind of ties into the market structure bill, because the concern that a lot of people have with Tether is that how much regulation are you going to get? So you have this like tension between the tech and an administration that's conflicts and ethics policies are just very different from what exists in the past. And so that creates a huge problem, because people want innovation and they want advancement. But does it have to come with this thing, like these kind of like blatant conflicts of interests and ethics problems that historically, culturally, were norms that we generally liked? And so that's the question, is the country's going to have to decide who does it want to be? And I think people are torn in between like where those decisions are headed.
Yeah, very interesting. So certainly, I think we have a lot more debate to have on this topic. There's a lot more questions than answers at this point. But Amanda, I think at this point, it would be wonderful to dive into some of your expertise. And you mentioned that your current role, you're focused on the travel rule. But I think for a lot of our listeners, the first question is, what is the travel rule and why was it created and how does it function?
I have to admit, when I was a prosecutor, I did a lot of work in the BSA AML space. And I went a shockingly long amount of time before I had to know what the travel rule was, because it's like a very niche kind of technical thing that most people don't really think about. They're familiar with KYC, CDD, EDD, right? Like all the things that we kind of normally focus on in compliance. But the travel rule is this very kind of interesting thing. It came from TradFi, like wire transmissions, and the idea that we wanted visibility. We wanted to know both what bank was sending money to what bank on the other end, and then who was sending money to whom, right? And so the FATF, the Financial Action Task Force, put recommendations into place that basically said, okay, crypto, yes, is technologically different, but you're still moving, right? Sometimes massive amounts of value. And we want to make sure that we know who the originator, and recipient is, but we also want to know like who's not just the VAS, the virtual asset service providers or crypto exchanges, not just which VAS are on each end, but who are the funds going to, right? So like if I'm sending money to you, you don't want a record that says I'm sending money to Mickey Mouse, or worse, I'm sending money to Al Qaeda and it doesn't get caught or seen by anyone, right? So you can't really have good fighting of illicit finance if you don't have good data, and that data relies on actually knowing who's sending the money. So the travel rule basically says, hey, if you're going to send funds, you need to include this information and verify, which is why our name pretty much says what we do, but you have to verify which VASP you're doing it with and who are the originator and the beneficiaries. And that information just travels with the funds.
That is a great explanation. And I think, maybe a good follow-up here is, how can the travel rule actually enable adoption instead of just adding friction? Because I think that is kind of the crux of the issue at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is I spend a lot of my time because I was a former prosecutor and I really try to be objective about the space, I actually spend a lot of my time speaking to like TradFi, banks, credit unions, and their hesitancy, for better or worse, right, is the perception that crypto, blockchain, Web3, this is all still criminal money. It's all a bunch of FTXs and SBFs waiting to happen. Like, for better or worse, due to like a lot of media focus on the bad and not so much focus on the good, you're not going to get a lot of institutional adoption if people don't have faith that there are these controls in place to fight money laundering and terrorist financing. The travel rule is one of the best ways that if you have a good travel rule compliance program, if you are in fact verifying, and not just like, you know, there are some tools where it just blasts a message out to compliance@exchange.com. That might be an email, that might not be an email, right? Like, that's not what we're talking about. That might be sufficient and questionable in different jurisdictions, but you don't just want like a bolt-on system. You want something that's designed to pre-verify, right? Like, who's sending the funds, who's receiving them, who are they for, who's getting them on the other end. And the amazing thing that I didn't know until I took this job was that if you have good travel rule compliance, you can practically eliminate impersonation scams. Like, there are entire categories of crime that we could be fighting a lot better. And one of the difficulties for law enforcement is that if the information is garbage, I'm sure you guys have heard this term, garbage in, garbage out. If we don't have that system, then law enforcement can't follow up if somebody says on the other end, well, Mickey Mouse received the money, and they have no idea who even received the money on the other end. So, like, from a intelligence perspective, like you mentioned Elliptic, David, earlier, the blockchain analytics companies like Elliptic, if the data is enriched, then you can do good blockchain analytics. But if you're just sitting there relying solely on on-chain data, that's wildly problematic, right? So the goal is to make the system much better, much more visible, and have that financial transparency. And then traditional institutions like banks, et cetera, they'll feel a lot better moving into a system that looks a lot more mature and a lot like what they're used to.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think really clears up, at least a lot of my questions around the travel rule. But Parth, maybe you want to step in here.
Well, Amanda, I'd love to know. I know we were having this conversation yesterday, but when you think about crypto, the ethos of crypto started with this dream of financial privacy. And it seems like, and if I'm trying to be the devil's advocate, things like the travel rule push the other way. So how would you talk about how we're sharing information or the risk of getting shut down by a banking system? I know there's a few technological advancements that are in the works around selective disclosure using zero-knowledge proofs and the difference between blank secrecy versus selective disclosure using zero-knowledge proofs. But what's your thinking as an ex-prosecutor?
Well, it's an amazing question. And the reason that I kind of like got all like itchy and about to geek out was because like you inherently use the term financial privacy. But actually, if you go back to the origins of crypto, back in even, I think it was 2017, I remember a guy from Coin Center, we were at a conference, and he basically was advocating for the anonymous free flow of money. And I asked him, I was like, you can't possibly be advocating after 9/11 for the truly anonymous free flow of money and the abolishment of AML-CFT. And he was like, but that's exactly what this technology enables. So there's a difference between anonymity and privacy, right? And if for anyone out there who didn't watch the last SEC roundtable on privacy, I would strongly encourage the first half, where some amazing companies like Espresso Systems, Alio, talking about the difference between privacy and anonymity. And it's the point that you just made that is critical, which is anonymity is we don't gather that information. We allow somebody to say Mickey Mouse. We have no idea that it's Parth sending the money. Privacy is we collect the information that it's Parth, but we hold it, we secure it, we encrypt it, and it's only given to law enforcement, judicial orders, asset recovery, if Parth is a criminal and we need to get it back to a victim, right? So people tend to use this term privacy and they really mean anonymity. And then some people don't understand like privacy isn't anonymity. And those two terms are very distinct. And to your point a minute ago, the advancements that crypto, blockchain, and Web3 have been making in that distinction and some of the tools where they're baking in compliance and they're baking in the concept of privacy as opposed to anonymity means that crypto can fix problems that TradFi has been fighting for years, especially in compliance. So that's why people like me who want to see like a nuanced evolution of rules and regulations that had good concepts, right? Fighting money laundering and terrorist financing. But maybe it's not the Bank Secrecy Act that we passed in the 70s for cash. And maybe we modify it to adapt to this tech, right? One of the things I love, shameless plug for VerifyVas, is that it was purpose-built, where they developed the tech for what FATF said. So it's verified, it's encrypted, it's auditable. It was like, how do we do this? How do we protect consumer data? How do we encrypt this? How do we send the information without just blasting it to some compliance at exchange email and worrying about what we're sending into the ether? So the problem is, you have all these like pieces that you have to think about when you're building these systems. And early crypto was like a toddler, kind of like ambling around and breaking things, right? And now you see very advanced, very mature companies building incredible things, which is what a lot of us are really excited about when we're thinking of the future of digital finance, digital identity, and all these pieces fitting together.
I think that's spot on. And at this point, I think maybe a quick commentary on the maturity of the market itself tells you that compliance is now becoming the new moat for that differentiates between a lot of these existing products and businesses. Do you feel the same way?
100%. The interesting thing about that, I love that you put it like a moat, because I feel like, you know, if you were in the compliance industry, I feel like for years, people have said, you know, compliance gives you that competitive edge.
It's the cost center. Yeah, initially.
But yeah, exactly. But it's actually like a double-edged sword, right? Because yes, it theoretically gives you a competitive edge, but it's also a cost center. So the competitive edge only works if you have enforcement, right? So you actually need agencies enforcing against the bad guys, because there were a number of exchanges in the United States that decided to register in the United States, decided to get licenses, spent millions on compliance programs, and then watched as other exchanges were allowed to grow to be transnational money laundering organizations with no enforcement. That's super problematic, because you're like, well, why should I keep throwing money at this cost center if there's literally no downside to not having compliance, right? So you have to have that enforcement aspect for it to, in fact, be a competitive edge. And I think we're seeing more companies, we've seen travel rule enforcement, we're seeing more countries around the world look at this, right? Especially examining crypto exchanges. Some countries are coming up for their FATF reevaluations. How well are they doing this? So it's a very like prevalent topic. But to your point about the moat, years ago, when people would say that, there was pushback from some folks in the industry because, in fairness, in the United States, when kind of like all of the industry was under attack, and you could make a strong argument that the previous administration really wasn't distinguishing between like good exchanges and bad exchanges, then there was a problem, right? Because it was very much like an all for one, one for all. Like when crypto was under attack, it was like circle the wagons, right? But now you're starting to see something really fascinating where, to your point earlier about market structure, we got the Genius Act. Like, you know, I think at one point President Trump called himself like the crypto president. Certainly, I think when you build your own Trump coin, you could argue that you're far more favorable to crypto than the previous administration. But now we're seeing this incredible opportunity where, like, if you watch these SEC roundtables, if you look at the agency engagement, when you're not under attack and the wagons uncircle, well, now these wagons can pick which path they want to go, and they can pick, are we still friends, or are you doing something shady that I want to report you to FinCEN for, or that I want to call out, right? Because now there's real competition. Before, you could say, oh, it's a moat, but if everybody's in the same castle, then you don't need that moat, right? So that's the fascinating thing that I think we're seeing now is basically, I jokingly call it the Harry Potter sorting hat of like, who's Gryffindor crypto and who's Slytherin crypto, right? Because who's going to choose this path, going back to David's earlier article about Tether, who's going to choose the path of having real sanctions programs? Who's going to choose the path of having real travel rule compliance, not just checkbox compliance, not just garbage compliance, but like who's going to do the things to make good crypto, and then who's going to continue on that anonymous free flow of money, wait till we get hit with an enforcement action? And that's, I think, the divergence that we're going to start, that we're already starting to see.
And as a Harry Potter fan, I think that's such an awesome analogy. And maybe what I would do is I'll take it a step further. So if we move beyond Hogwarts, and if you look at outside domestic markets, international markets, we're seeing these two different worlds emerge. So in the US, you have a lot of these companies that are piling on compliance tools to sometimes maybe win over regulators and these banks. But then if you think about places like Asia or Europe, things are moving really fast towards agreeing on the straight same travel rule standards. And so my concern is that you might actually end up being in these two big bubbles, and those bubbles don't talk to each other. So from the big picture trends, where do you see how do these paths converge eventually? Because you have on one side Asia and Europe building standards, and then in the US, it's more focused around being compliant to the agencies involved domestically. How do you think of that?
That's such a great question. And like, what I'm fascinated by is we had that. I don't know if people realize it. I talk about it in my book, but like people don't realize that that's effectively what happened with the weaponization of the US dollar after 9/11 and sanctions. So if you think about, we had basically two bubbles. You had the US dollar system, and then you had everybody who was excluded from it and everybody who wanted to get into it. And essentially, I'm oversimplifying and generalizing here, the concept was, well, you have good money, right? And then you have sanctioned bad money. Now, there are a lot of people who would argue, and I talk about in my book, how some of those sanctions did real horrible damages. So some people say, well, we kind of overused our sanctions program, and maybe that bad money pool included some people who shouldn't be in there. Valid question, right? Valid argument to make. But what I think you're seeing is that system moving over to crypto. But what's fascinating in crypto is because a lot of crypto, especially like open viewable blockchains, right, in that system, you have so much transparency and you can actually see. And there are companies that are building incredible things like tools that can access sanctions exposure pre-validation before the transaction is even approved. So when you look at what's being built, you can easily see that two bubble system that you're talking about kind of morphing into the digital finance version, which is who's signing up to be verified, who's signing up for digital identity, who's signing up to participate in, we know who you are, we know what you're doing, right? Versus, you know, sanctions, we're criminals, et cetera. And we don't want to put our dirty money in a system that's cooperating with law enforcement, et cetera. Right now, there's too much of a blend of that, which makes it really hard, right? Because like to David's point earlier, if Iran is buying all this Tether and all of a sudden you're having to ask Tether to like burn and reissue, well, if Tether doesn't join a verified system that requires vast originator beneficiary, well, now people are going to have to decide, well, if I use Tether, does that mean I'm mixing my money with Iran? And I actually know people who have purchased USDC instead of USDT because they were really uncomfortable with what Tether was doing, right? So there are some people, and that wasn't even an American, that was somebody from outside the country. There are people who are looking at, what money do I want to put my system in? Same reason why a lot of us didn't put, if we converted our money into crypto, a lot of us didn't put our money into Tornado Cash because we knew what else was in there. I don't care how much privacy I want. I'm going to do some research on mixers, right? So like, your question reflects this fascinating, like, yes, it might end up becoming two bubbles, but what if, instead of it was a bubble of one country that unilaterally decides who gets to play in the system, it's this whole system of, no, we have the originator benefit, right? We can know everything that's going on. And so I think that's why so many of us in AML, CFT, moved over from government, moved over from TradFi. When you start to get into the technological level and you see the improvements that can be made, you're like, okay, what we have now isn't perfect, but we see a place where we can get to. And that's like where so many of us are fighting, what so many of us are fighting for is how do we get to crypto for good? You're never going to eliminate crime, but at least we could theoretically get to a place where the system acknowledges this is what's clean and this is who's trying to do it right and this is who's dirty.
That's such an awesome way to put it. Amanda, I'd love to know, based on your comments around how we think about crypto compliance, you obviously went from being a federal prosecutor at the DOJ, now working on the front lines of making crypto safer and more compliant. But I want to take you back to when you were at the DOJ. What were the biggest aha moments from your prosecutor days that still shape the way you think about crypto even today and the conversation that we've been having? Like, did you ever see a case of bad actors using crypto in a certain way which made you think, well, here's how it should be. Here's what compliant crypto looks like.
You know, that's such a good question that nobody's ever asked me. And it actually requires some introspective thought. Not that the rest didn't, sorry. It's just like, that's like a really tough, like personal question. I think one of the interesting things that I saw was I was one of like the handful of prosecutors in like 2012, 2013. There was a small number of us that were catching these crypto cases. My agent was like, do you know what a Bitcoin is? I was like, that's not a real thing. He was like, no, it is. And you need to learn about it because we got a guy laundering a lot of it. And so like we were kind of like thrown into learning about this stuff. And I remember my first crypto money laundering case. He was a brilliant guy. And he was on the dark nets and he saw that you had a lot of drug dealers who were getting crypto and wanted to convert it to cash. And you had a lot of drug users who needed crypto, like needed to convert their cash to crypto to buy drugs. And there was a market opportunity there, right? Convert cash to crypto, crypto to cash. And, you know, sadly, he ended up like his life did not go well because he chose to knowingly look at basically laundering money for drug dealers in a system that, like, I don't care, like, what you, your personal beliefs are about drugs. We can have that debate. But when you decide to violate the law, that's a problem. And what I think is really interesting, because I was having this conversation the other day with a brilliant friend of mine, when you look at what happened in Tornado Cash, there's a very interesting conundrum that we're coming to, which is about intent and the system that we want to live in, which is, if somebody writes a piece of code and they just release it out into the wild and they don't have any control over it and they don't make any money from it, should they or could they be held responsible for that currently under the law that we have? Now, 99.9% of the people in crypto are not doing that. They're not as decentralized as they want to make it sound. They keep a lot of control and they make a ton of money, right? And so, like, that's a very different thing. But it's an interesting thing about the intent of some of these people, what they know and what they're choosing. And I see a lot of people in crypto build for good, have an amazing concept of what their product could be used for, and then be horrified when somebody uses their product for bad. And I think this concept that I had to shift from when I was a prosecutor is, you know, I didn't prosecute bad people. I prosecuted people who made really bad choices. And if you could get to that point and realize that, then we as a society have to ask, what do we want to prosecute people for doing, right? Like, what level of intent do we need? And that was one of the things that got lost in the Tornado Cash case, was if you get really into the weeds of the tech and what they built, you know, it's really complicated. But if you just get to the fact of, they built a money laundering machine, they knew it, and they gave it to money launderers, and they kept doing it when they knew that money launderers were using it. Is that something that we want to allow people to do? And sometimes you have to bring it back down to, like, the basics of the social contract, because that's all our laws are. It's just a social contract. And am I comfortable prosecuting someone for their, for just writing code and releasing it when they didn't have the bad intent that it be used this way? No. But when they invent something, control it, make money off of it, see how it's being used, and then perpetuate the illegality. And we have to start, like, we almost have to overhaul so much of our legal system. Because my friend was like, if a law's been on the books for 50 years, it should be abolished. Like, if you're not going to fix it, it should be abolished. That's a reasonable thing, because some of our laws, like the BSA, have been on the books since 1970s, and there have been improvements, but BSA modernization has been sitting in the basement of FinCEN for far too long, right? And when you look at how far crypto, blockchain, Web3, all of this digitalization is moving, we need almost an overhaul in so much. And that is a level of, like, government movement that is so impossible to imagine, because you don't just need the move fast break things that this administration is doing, right? Like, you don't need bulldozers and explosives. You need chisels. You need scalpels. You need intelligent people in there. And so it's a long-winded way of saying that, like, now I feel like our system, it was one of the reasons why I left DOJ. It was just, it's very hard to make change from within, but, like, our system needs a change, and it needs to be a recognition of the nuance and who do we want to be as a society. And there's not, like, a right answer to that. There's answers that some of us have, but, like, we have to choose, what do we want the BSA in 2026 to look like? It had a lot of problems. And I'm just using the BSA as an example, but the Bank Secrecy Act. But we have to be able to have those conversations. And if you just stick in a system and do it over and over and over, because that's the way we've always done it, regardless of how broken it is. And if you look at the justice system, you could argue that's what it's become. Then we need to start having some really tough conversations. And if it all needs to be burned down and restarted, then hopefully there's people on the other side who are intelligent, know the technology, and have, like, the moral framework that we want for how to rebuild it. And I think that's the very long-winded answer to a really incredibly thoughtful question.
Amanda, that was wonderful. I mean, I don't think that we can move any further from that.
Yeah. I'm just, for the listeners, I'm clapping. That's the visual that we have. That was such a great answer, Amanda. Like, that needs to go cut as a segment and then go out there on Twitter or on other places.
Well, it's, you know, nobody asked the question like that. And you really forced me to do some, like, self-analysis that I probably did on the fly. And I'll probably have to process a lot of that later over some tea with over some hard tea, maybe.
The reason why you had the 2-second Like honestly, for those 2 seconds, I was just speechless, and that's why Matt and I were just looking at each other's faces. That was such a great answer.
Well, listen, Amanda, I think that we are just about time here, but thank you so much for joining us. Before we go, would you just want to mention your book? I think that all of our listeners should check it out.
Yeah, I will say big caveat, because I had some people who were upset that only two of the chapters talk about like crypto, disintermediated finance, blockchain tech, because those are like catalysts amongst other major catalysts, like the American economy, you know, the rise of nationalism, like other things. So it's a book about the major things. The idea was give people a 360 view. So instead of having to read 20 books on each catalyst, just give people, I mean, I know this sounds cheesy, but I always go back to the opening scene of Newsroom. Remember the Jeff Daniels, right? Why we're no longer the greatest country in the world, because we don't have an informed populace. And with a 7 second attention span and people reading less and less books, I was like, if we don't write one book that basically informs people what's going on instead of the 20 that they would need to read. So it's a breadth, not depth book. So if you really want to know like what's happening in geopolitics and all the things that are impacting the financial world order and how they all crash into each other, I strongly recommend it unbiasedly. And I tried to make it very unbiased. It talks about politics without being political. And I think those are the conversations that we need to have. So thank you for mentioning it. I tend to forget. And like love the feedback. If anyone reads it, always open to edits and suggestions for the next edition.
Awesome. Well, I can also second that. I think it's a wonderful book. And I actually think a lot of the topics are very near and dear to most of the participants in the crypto industry. And so while maybe they're not right on the nose all about crypto, I think they're important discussions that as an industry and as a community, we all like to have those discussions. Amanda, thank you so much for your time. Parth, David, thank you so much for a great conversation. And thank you to the listeners for joining us today. We will talk to you in 2 weeks.
Thanks for having me.
Crypto as an asset class is highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is for investors with a high risk tolerance. Crypto may also be more susceptible to market manipulation than securities. Crypto is not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Investors in crypto do not benefit from the same regulatory protections applicable to registered securities.
Past performance is no guarantee of future results.
This podcast was produced by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice, and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and are not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2025 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 1040156.